So we have several messengers that are spoken of throughout the book. This is another one. The priest is a messenger. We are to be messengers of God. But he says to the priest in verse 8, "You are departed out of the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Eternal of Hosts." So the priest despised God. Christ made a statement, very familiar statement that we ought to know by now, Matthew 23, verse 23. And the whole chapter 23 is how they despised God and God's laws as they got very minute with certain laws like the mint and the anise and the cumin. But judgment, mercy, faith, opening the way to the kingdom of God, he talks about within that chapter, and the widows. He said, look, you've made it a double burden for the widows to be a part of God's way of life, because of some of the rules and the restrictions and the things they took away from them and they weren't carefully considering them. So you've departed out of the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Eternal of Hosts. Therefore have I also made you contemptible and base before all the people, according as you have not kept my ways, but have been partial in the law. They knew the law, but they were very partial. And those who had the money to pay for legal counsel and legal help and who could, through their bribes, could get their way, then, you know, they were quick to respond, oh, but the law says this and that. But because of the problems, we see a cycle that was set up. Let me just talk through these. We're starting another number one. Okay, we're talking about a cycle now and how this developed. As we read in chapter 1, verses 7 and 8, and verse 13, the priests were not properly sacrificing and performing their duties. So right now we're just looking at an overview then of what has taken place to this point. They weren't properly sacrificing. There was improper tithing, point number two. Improper tithing in chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. In verse 14, the word vow is referring to a free will offering. A free will offering which would be given during times of trouble and of difficulties. Well, they weren't properly coming to God and giving offerings. They weren't properly tithing and giving offerings. Chapter 3, verse 8. Therefore, and this is still part of number 2, improper tithing led to inadequate funding to do the work. The people weren't tithing properly. Therefore, there weren't the funds to do the work. Point number 3. The priests had to work themselves in order to survive. They had to go and work in their gardens, in their little farms, vineyards, whatever it was that was their particular endeavor. In order to survive, you can tie in Nehemiah 13, verse 10 to that. Nehemiah 13, verse 10. So they had to work gardens to survive, and therefore it further impaired their ability to perform their duties. I mean, if you've got to be working in order to make money, you're not able to go out and to preach and teach the people. But Paul refers to that in the New Testament. The fact that Philippi had helped him so that he could continue to preach. He would stop, and apparently he was in Corinth for a couple of years, in Ephesus for a couple of years on his journeys, because he needed to make some money. He had to have the money so he could continue his travels. Kind of like some of you, Russ is already talking, he got back from this bike trip, and now he's all keen on bicycling, you know. So now he's going to graduate, and he's going to work for a month, then he's going to go on a bicycle trip across the United States. I mean, all these idyllic ideas of college students. Guys, I figured that was going to happen. And who's supposed to sponsor him? Yeah, yeah. There's an idea for you. Well, let's see. Maybe that's how I'll recover from all this work on this doctorate stuff, see? And maybe I could get some units for traveling across the United States, preaching to the brethren. There you go. I can preach. And anyway, I better go back to my garden. I make out better that way than doing that. So anyway, this impaired their ability to do their work. Point number 4. The people then got furious at the reprobate priests. I mean, how can the priests get any kind of tithes? Because after all, they're out working, they're doing these things, they still have physical, financial blessings to a certain degree, and they were upset because they weren't then doing their job and preaching whatever, so they got mad and they quit tithing, some of them probably altogether. But at least they pulled back from their tithes. So they were upset. Therefore, God cursed them. Point number five. God cursed them, and the crops failed. The people were then warned in chapter 3, verse 8. Chapter 3, verse 8. You've robbed God. And he then shows that the curses upon the land have been a result of not properly tithing. The not properly tithing ties in with the idea that therefore the priests weren't properly doing their work too. So it's this cycle that gets started and it just continued until finally God says, look, you guys go to work and teach the people to tithe. You people start tithing. So he then breaks that cycle. So they're warned and the people responded. Point number seven. The people did respond, and the cycle waits to start all over again, and eventually, of course, it did start over again. Point six, the people were warned by God. The people were warned by God in chapter 3, verse 8, to start tithing, start doing the work, and in turn, blessings will come. Prove me now herewith that once you start tithing that there won't be blessings. Again, it's this warning. David. It is the cycle of sin that was established in the book of Malachi. The sins of the priests, it's just the cyclical nature in how it got established, and it went on and on until finally God steps in. Very similar, is it not, to the sins that we read back in 520. When we get the cyclical thing going, people are so busy with their own homes, they don't have time for building God's temple. After all, there are laws that say you can't build a temple, so therefore we're justified not doing that. And this cycle kind of gets set up until finally God stops it by warning people. He says, look, here's my house. It's supposed to be built. Start building. And that's the story of Haggai and the first half of Zechariah. So we find, you know, a few years go by and they totally lose their commitment. Okay, verse 10. Number two was improper tithing led to inadequate funding to do the work. Okay. The priest didn't properly sacrifice was point number one. Point number two, improper tithing led to inadequate funding to do the work. Therefore, they had to go to work. Point number three. As they went to work, the people got more and more angry because the priests weren't doing their job, so they tithed less and less. Point number five, God cursed them. So now the crops start failing. And this takes, you know, a period of time, a few seasons, and now the crops aren't working. So God then warns them, point number six, and then the people respond, point number seven, in order to break the cycle. Okay, verse 10. Have we not all one Father? Have we not one God who created us? Why do we deal treacherously every man against his brother by profaning the covenant of the fathers? So he's saying here they should be worshiping Israel's God, not the heathen gods. We have now made a transition in part to the people's sins. We had the priest's sins, chapter 2, verse 1 through 9. Now we pick up with the people. Don't they have one Father? Hasn't he created us? Why do the people deal treacherously against their brothers? In profaning the covenant which has laws of love within it, of helping one another within the covenant. If someone owed money, they might work for them, but after 7 years, they're supposed to be, well, after 6 years, there's supposed to be some release. After six or after seven? Three, six, it's in the seventh, and then I think it's after seven, right? I'll have to look that up again as far as the technicalities of it. But anyway, the year of release is the seventh year. That covers it either way. That's released, and I think it's at the end of that time, that then you start over again. If they weren't able to pay it, you release that debt. And then they're able to get out of debt and go on with their lives. But they were not keeping the covenant of their fathers. Judah has dealt treacherously. An abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the holiness of the Eternal, which he loved, and has married the daughter of a strange god. So we see that the holiness, the sanctuary, was defiled. We read that earlier because the sacrifices weren't properly being done in chapter 1. Judah has profaned the holiness. So we can have this, the sanctuary. We can also have the holy people as a second aspect of that. The holy people were profaned because they weren't keeping God's law. And they are married to the daughter of a strange god. He's emphasizing that they had married, spiritually speaking, as well as, I suppose, physically, those of other religions. And it often led to apostasy. When he speaks here of miscegenation, that of marrying across races, it is in the context of marrying into other religions and leaving God. And that's why God was so upset with it. Verse 12, the Eternal will cut off the man that does this, the master and the scholar, out of the tabernacles of Jacob, and him that offers an offering unto the Lord of hosts. So the violators are then going to be cut off. They're going to lose their rights, their opportunities. And him that offers an offering unto the Eternal of hosts, Proverbs 15, verse 8. Proverbs 15, verse 8 says that God will not accept the sacrifice of the wicked. So the sacrifice of the wicked is to be cut off. And this have you done again, covering the altar of the Eternal with tears, with weeping and with crying out, insomuch that God regards not the offering anymore or receives it with goodwill at your hand. Who was doing the weeping here? There are two possibilities, and maybe both categories are correct. First of all, they were instructed to divorce the wives of false religions because these were taking them out and away from God. And there's speculation that it's their weeping and their crying and all these problems, and therefore there was a softness in the hearts of the people that, maybe we can't go ahead with this. But yet God had instructed it for that particular time because of that culture and because of the religious significance. Secondly, it's just the people in general realizing their loss of blessings, the people crying and realizing, things are going so bad. Verse 14, then he continues, yet you say, wherefore? Why all these things? Why does it take place? They were still trying to justify themselves. They're still saying, but God, we're your people. He gets more specific here, and he really talks about three different types of covenants in the book of Malachi. We're going to talk now about the marriage covenant. We have been talking about the covenant of duty, the covenant of responsibility. Chapter 2, verses 4, 5, and 8. It's talking about the covenant. You can go back to chapter 2, verse 4. It says, my covenant. And verse 5 and verse 8. This would be the covenant of duty, of responsibility of the priests, the duties of Levi. He's now talking to the people that there was a covenant of marriage that they were to withhold. Verse 14, yet you say, wherefore? Because Eternal has been witness against you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and the wife of your covenant. There were vows that were taken. There was responsibility to Levi. There are now vows he's talking about here, the vows of the people in the covenant that they had with their mates. We make a vow with our mate. He said they weren't keeping it. For did he not make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit, he made one way of life, approach. Is the best translation from the Hebrew according to the commentaries. A point to be made in verse 14, monogamy is assumed here. The wife of your youth is not plural, it's singular. The Jews believe that there is no specific statement in the Old Testament against polygamy. But I would say that there is a spirit of the law, and there is, you can do enough reading when you go back to Genesis 2 and here in Malachi chapter 2 to determine that it was best and it was intended for individuals to have one wife. Of course, they'll go back and they'll talk about Abraham and Jacob. I believe Isaac to be one of the few in the Old Testament that had really a basically good marriage, and one of the reasons was he had one wife. He could attend to the needs and the attitudes and whatever, probably a little bit better than others that had two or three different attitudes that might be fighting against each other and fighting against him, and I will go right on. Anyway, monogamy is assumed here. Yet she's your companion. So, you know, there's supposed to be friendship. I think that's one of the greatest aspects of marriage, is the aspect of the friendship, being a companion for life, the wife of your covenant. Okay, anyway, yet did he not make one, that there would be one way of life, one avenue towards God, and that is through the residue of the Spirit, or the excellency of the Spirit, through the Spirit of God. James?
I have a question back on 14.
Okay.
It speaks about dealing treacherously with the wife of their covenant deal. And yet, you had mentioned how God had instructed them to put away their wives that had been married from outside of grace. There was a provision in the Old Testament, if I remember correctly, for taking in a wife, say, captured in war or something.
Right. And what was one of the provisions? She had to assume the religion of Israel, and that was adamant that had to take place. And of course, Solomon then broke that, and he built temples for other gods and whatever. So those restrictions then were no longer kept. So that by this time, the problem had gotten so great that it was, if you go back to Nehemiah anyway, the problem at that particular point, because of the intermarriage that led to false religion, and it, within the context it talks about the false religion, that at that point it was just decided for the priests especially and those of Judah that they were to separate from the wives that they had taken of other religions, and to do that at that point. Okay, verse 15. Wherefore one, why does he have one way? Why is the covenant, whether we're talking about the Abrahamic covenant or the marriage covenant, there is some debate, you know, as to which way, because we've got the covenant of our fathers in verse 10, which is talking more about the Abrahamic covenant. We see the wife of your covenant, verse 14, and I would take that to be the marriage covenant, so maybe we've got three covenants here, one of duty, one of the old covenant the promises, the covenant with the fathers, which would be the Abrahamic covenant in verse 10. Verse 14 then with the wife. He says, why does he do these things? Why does he have these covenants with mankind? That he might seek a godly seed. That he can build God's family. I mean, why is there the covenant within marriage of fidelity? So that God can build a godly seed. So we see the goal of marriage is to build God's family. Psalms 127, verse 1, unless the Lord shall build a house. One of the things that is an incidental point here is that children in that society followed the religion of the mother, because it was the mother's responsibility to carry on and to teach in those very early formative years. Until finally they became of school age, and then often they went then to a tutor or to a schoolmaster who would then teach them. But it was the mother's responsibility, and there was a great concern on God's part that if these marriages do stay together that are of intermixing religions, that then the mothers at that point, and I'm not an expert on all these aspects of what the marriage is there at that point, but predominantly the problem was men marrying women of other religions, and therefore that those women would then teach the children. What happens after a generation or two of that? Well, no longer are the customs of the land of Israel and of Judah being kept. It's now the customs of the Edomites, the Arab customs, these other ideas that would then become the central part of the culture. So that's one of the reasons why God was concerned about it. Again, I think we have to keep it somewhat in a cultural setting there, as well as the fact that he is trying to establish the worship and bring people back from the curses that they had incurred. Take heed to your spirit, in other words, to your attitude, your spirit, the spirit in man, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. To deal treacherously. God says he's very angry about those who deal treacherously. We live in a time of abuse, where some men think that they can be dominant, that they can, that they have the right to slap a wife around. Nowhere in the Bible does it give the man that opportunity. But they were dealing treacherously against the wife of their youth. In a society that allowed polygamy, as was allowed. I'm not saying it was intended. It wasn't intended, but it was allowed. There were wives of youth. Oftentimes, the wife within their own culture, whatever, after their marriage for a period of time, within a polygamous culture, then they'll take other, generally younger wives. Just the way it tends to work out. The first wife has to be in agreement with that, or she may divorce the husband. If she divorces him, she takes with her the dowry, but then she doesn't have a husband, and the chances of remarriage are slim and none at that particular point. I mean, in our society, it's basically that way. The most difficult time for remarriage is for those women a little bit older. If they have teenage children, they get divorced. The chances are pretty slim of remarrying. So he talks about the wife of his youth. You know, how many of these that were married that the problems with the children and growing up and in other religions, how many of them had, you know, other wives? I don't know. But anyway, the wife of his youth, you're to deal well with the wife of your youth. You know that it was only in 1948 or 1967 before Israel finally passed a law against polygamy? Because the Jews really believe that polygamy is a legitimate thing, but because of current culture, they decided, look, we can't continue with this because of the problems. However, if one is married in a polygamous relationship before they come to Israel, they can then take those wives with them, but they can't now marry in Israel, in the state of Israel, more than one wife, unless it was already before, you know, before the time that that law had gone into existence. Verse 16, for the Eternal, the God of Israel, says he hates putting away. He hates divorce, in other words. For one covers violence with his garment, says the Eternal of hosts, therefore take heed to your spirit that you deal not treacherously. So the garment which is supposed to cover and to protect. It was Ruth and Boaz, right? And the garment that's laid at Boaz's feet and whatever. It's for protection. It's, you know, and the garment that is for warmth. He says, you're covering violence with the garments. You know, you cover the bruises of battered wives. And in some situations, battered husbands. It's much more prevalent the other direction. So they use their garments to cover the violence to the marriage covenant. We know that God hates divorce. We'll just finish up with this verse. God hates sin. He hates divorce and what divorce does to people, to children. He does not hate the divorcee. And I think we have to make that delineation. I was watching the program at noon, and it's the one on family today. And this verse he was going over, Dr. Albert was, and made a specific point of, yes, God is against divorce. Now, however, that doesn't mean that there aren't some legitimate reasons for divorce. And I don't think he went into those reasons. I think he advertised the booklet at that point. But we know that there is sometimes fraud that leads to the need for divorce. That fraud may be general, or it may be specific. It may be sexual fraud, where some have married not realizing that their mate was homosexual. because they've never been told. They get into a marriage relationship, and then when they find out, that is fraught. Porneia, which would be sex before marriage, where one did not know and had been told by the other or believed the other to be virginous when they then got married and then find out sometime afterwards if indeed that would have changed their mind to marry the person, that could be considered fraud. The first reason is fraud. Two subpoints under that, general and sexual fraud. The second is desertion. That if a mate leaves another mate and they just leave, that doesn't leave the other mate to live singly the rest of their life. No, at that point they may go ahead with a divorce and then to remarry if that's in the cards. The point that God is making in verse 16 is they needed to forgive and to reconcile their marriages. They needed to forgive each other. Now this, it's not simply the matter of foreign marriages and that being split up. At this point, he's talking about marriages within Israel. So, I mean, we've segued and maybe we're, you know, I mentioned too much about the other and that's tied in too much with this. In verse 16, he's talking about those that were divorcing the wife of their youth in order to, you know, either remarry or just because they were tired of her, whatever the reasons were, he says that that was treachery. That they were not to be divorcing. They should have been working out their problems, forgiving one another, and reconciling. Okay, we'll pick up with verse 7.